You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today,
it's just a huge story in the physics and astronomy world, which almost made me cry.
We begin counting down the biggest stories of the year with quantum physicist Ian Durham.
Imagine you're them and you see this and you're like, whoa, did I just... Wow, really? I mean, because you see this thing pop out and you're just like, oh my God.
Welcome to the Foundational Questions Institute's countdown of the biggest and best science stories of 2020. I'm Zia Morali, and once again, I'm joined by FQXI member and quantum physicist Ian Durham of St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. So, Ian, thank you very much for joining us at almost the end of this extremely miserable and eventful year.
Yes, thanks for having me.
But we're going to cheer everyone up.
We're going to try.
We'll try our best to talk about some of the good things that have been happening this year in the world of science and foundational physics mainly. I should say this could be even more exciting than usual because just seconds before we started recording, you were still trying to work out which order to put the things on your list. So, you know, it could all change.
It could be one of those moments where hand me the envelope, please. And then I open the envelope and it's not what I originally had.
It's La La Land.
Right.
Right, okay, so we usually start with things that almost got into the list but didn't, honourable mentions, dishonourable mentions, all that sort of stuff. So since this is the year of COVID, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, so I was debating over whether this was a physics-y thing, and then I thought to myself, as a physicist, everything is physics. And in fact, this is not just physics, this is quantum physics, ultimately.
Okay, let's see you make this case. This is interesting. Go on.
I can make a case that everything is quantum mechanics. But anyway, the vaccines.
We're talking now specifically about the mRNA vaccines that, at least at the time of this recording, are the first and only vaccines to have been approved in the UK and the US and in Europe, and have begun to be rolled out in some countries.
The reason these vaccines are so incredible, there are a number of world records that were sort of broken here. The first is that this is, I believe, a world record for the rapidity with which a vaccine was developed and released to market.
Yeah, the rapidity has been really remarkable, but for some it has caused concern. So can we talk about how they were able to do this so fast without compromising safety?
I will say that some of the technology has actually been there for quite some time, and that the essence of the vaccine actually existed, I had heard, several years ago. It was either Pfizer or Moderna. What's interesting is that these vaccines are also incredibly effective, depending on which company you're going with. It's like some were showing 95% effectiveness. What people don't realize is that's actually a lot higher than some vaccines, typical vaccines. You know, a lot like the flu shot, I don't believe is nearly that effective.
Yeah, I think flu is about 50 to 60%. So this is a massive improvement.
Yeah. It's a huge improvement. And when they announced that, I was like shocked. What it does, it uses a sort of a newish technology. They're called mRNA vaccines.
So it's maybe worth quickly first talking about how vaccines usually work. And indeed, some of the COVID vaccines in development are using these traditional methods. So in the conventional method that we're used to, a weakened or inactive part of the virus is injected into the body, stimulating the immune system to create antibodies to protect the person.
This is maybe something I should just talk a little bit about because I think it's important. I want to make sure that all our listeners get the vaccine. Please get the vaccine. This is a very important thing. Vaccines are an old technology, and the concept of inoculation goes back thousands of years, believe it or not. I believe it was developed in India or Pakistan, somewhere in that area. The idea is that if you get exposed to a disease, you develop some antibodies to it, right? They didn't know what the antibodies were back then, but they did understand this idea of inoculation. And someone picked up this idea from India and then brought it to the West in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And that's when they developed sort of the modern version of it. It's an ancient technology. And this idea is that they'll inject people with a very small amount of a virus or a disease. So the idea is to stimulate the immune response without giving you the disease. So it's sort of like right on the edge there. And then technology got better where we could develop synthetic versions of these vaccines and things like that.
Right, and now the mRNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna that we're talking about here do something different, right? They don't inject you with a small weakened part of the virus or disease. Instead, the mRNA carries instructions into the body to our cells to create a harmless piece of the spike protein. So, you know, those famous spikes we keep seeing on the news every day on the COVID particle surface. Our body is then stimulated to create an immune response to that piece of protein. And it does this without affecting our own DNA in any way. So it's not dangerous to us.
DNA is sort of the code of life, and then RNA is sort of related to DNA, and I always get this mixed up, but viruses lack their own RNA or DNA.
This is why physicists shouldn't be talking about biology, really, isn't
it? I know, this is why physicists shouldn't be talking about this. Because so there's this big debate about whether viruses are actually living things or not, because they lack one of these. I think they lack DNA, and then they... I don't know.
Oh, well, here we are. Most viruses have either RNA or DNA as the genetic material. There we go.
But the point is they don't have both. That's the key.
Right.
They don't have
both.
So an mRNA vaccine is a type of vaccine that basically uses a man-made copy of messenger RNA. And that stimulates the immune response in the body. That's pretty amazing. And it's, as we've seen, proven to be extremely effective. I should say, where's the quantum mechanics in this? So the quantum mechanics is that this is operating at a molecular level, and molecules are a quantum mechanical concept.
That's a very poor justification for making that about quantum mechanics.
I don't know. The entire field of chemistry is just a sub-discipline of quantum mechanics. Anyways, there's a biologist who's listening to this right now who's cringing and thinking, oh my God. Anyway, that's my little COVID pitch. Get your vaccines. Cool stuff. Quantum mechanics is everywhere.
Excellent, excellent. Public service announcement over and done with there. So now we'll turn to more traditional kind of physics stories.
Yes.
That also didn't make the list but are worth mentioning. So where do we turn now, Ian?
Well, we're going to turn to one that's not really a discovery per se. It's just a huge story in the physics and astronomy world. And that was the collapse of the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, which almost made me cry. I've never actually been there, and I'm so sad that I never got to see it. If you don't know Arecibo, it was in the movie Contact. It was in a James Bond film. It was this giant radio telescope in the mountains of Puerto Rico. And for a long time, it was the largest single-dish radio telescope in the world. I think there's a Chinese one that is bigger.
And so just to sort of quickly run through some of its scientific achievements. So it's been around for 57 years. It was completed in 1963. And
some of the greatest discoveries in astronomical history were made there.
So this is where they discovered the first ever binary pulsar. And, you know, that led to a Nobel Prize in physics. It was the first observatory to spot planets outside of Earth's solar system. And in 1974, it sent out the most powerful broadcast, deliberately beamed into space to try to kind of contact alien life.
Yep, it has a long history in the SETI community. And what happened was, sometime earlier this year, a portion of the scope collapsed and punched a hole in the dish. There was talk of trying to repair it, but then for various reasons, some of which were political, there wasn't money. Maybe about a month ago or so, they shut the thing down. They deemed it unsafe. So there's a big dish, absolutely enormous dish that took up this whole valley, and there were the electronics were suspended over the top. That stuff was hanging above the big dish. And there were some structural issues, and a few weeks ago, in the early hours of the morning, one of the cables snapped. There's video on the web of the actual cable snapping. Like, there was a camera mounted up there, and you can see where it snaps. It just snaps. And that whole thing, it just collapsed, fell down, and then the whole dish went. It's really, 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 really sad. However, Arecibo was important beyond just what people know it for. Arecibo was the largest radar in the world.
Okay.
They didn't do just astronomy there. They did climate research. It was very important when Hurricane Maria came through and devastated Puerto Rico. It was very important then, and it was very important during other hurricanes. Whenever there are hurricanes, they used Arecibo, as well as the folks at Arecibo. They have a lot of radio operators at Arecibo, and the radio guys are, many of them are ham radio licensed. So they're licensed amateur radio guys, even though they're professionals. And they use them for emergency coordination and stuff. And it was a big economic engine for Puerto Rico. And it was a source of major pride for the Caribbean. And there is now a big push to try to convince the incoming administration to rebuild it. So I'm hopeful. Who knows?
Come back next year and we'll find out what happened to it.
Maybe we'll hear that they'll have funded it. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay, what else? What else hasn't made the list?
So staying on the space theme, this would have been number one had it been confirmed.
Right.
There was a report that came out a few months back that astronomers had seen a signal of phosphine in Venus's atmosphere. There was a big debate about this because phosphine doesn't come from just anywhere. Phosphine is typically associated with organic life. There are other possibilities for sources of phosphine. In particular, there are some geochemical processes that could produce phosphine. But generally speaking, on Earth anyway, it's only made in significant quantities by microbes and chemists. We're pretty sure there are no chemists on Venus. So, you know, the idea was that there were possibly microbes. People were all amazed after this. That report is now somewhat in doubt. Other astronomers began to criticize the result almost immediately, and there were sort of four independent studies that came out and said that they couldn't reproduce the results. The original group went back and reanalyzed their data, and they downgraded their claims. It doesn't mean that they didn't see phosphine, just that it's at levels about 7 times lower than they first reported.
Do we know how such a sort of a mistake, or, you know, how does that come about? How is it that you go about sort of announcing a really dramatic result and then having to pull it back? What went wrong in their analysis, if something went wrong?
Oh boy, that's a $1 million question. People misunderstand, I think, how science is done, especially with things of this nature. When you take data in a laboratory, you're taking data points. So in particular, you're picking out a signal. So when you're looking at phosphine in a gas or something like that, you're picking out a signal from noise. So what do? You have this data that comes in, and it comes in and you're getting these measurements coming in from, in this case, Venus. If you were to plot that data on a screen, you'd get a jaggedy line across your screen. Hidden within that jaggedy line are signals of the gases that are in there. So first of all, you have to be confident in each of the data points that make up the jaggedy line, because some of those data points could represent, so if you have a photo detector, it could represent a bad photoreceptor on the chip. So you have to, first of all, smooth out the noise that is caused by things like bad pixels and stuff. So that's one source of error. So what do? And then you have this jaggedy line. Let's say you're now confident that this jaggedy line, you've taken all the bad data out. You want to get that jaggedy line so that it actually you see things in it. You want to be able to see signals. Different chemicals will contribute different parts to the jaggedy line. The jaggedy line is made up of actually lots of different signals that are put together. So there's this thing called Fourier analysis, and they'll run something like a Fourier transform on it. But doing that, getting it to work right, this is the same technology, by the way, that goes into decompression of JPEGs and, you know, making a fuzzy picture less fuzzy. But doing that, you have to pick these certain computational values really carefully, you know, and you have to kind of massage them. I want to emphasize to our listeners that it's not cheating. You're not picking these and presupposing something. So it's not like, well, you want to see phosphine, so you're going to pick the numbers to be this. No, what you're doing is you're picking numbers so that you see something. Because if you don't pick the right numbers, you won't see anything. It'll just be blah. So then you pick the right numbers, and then suddenly something pops out. So in this case, I'm guessing that something popped out at them. They were like, whoa. And then when they matched it up, it looked like it was phosphine. And I think they're standing behind the fact that it's phosphine. The question is how much? And so the value of how much has to do with the strength of the signal. That's where, you know, maybe they had to tweak a coefficient in their computational analysis such that's where the uncertainty comes in the amount. They're pretty certain that they got that signal. They see phosphine. The question is how much is actually there?
You mentioned that other groups started to criticize them quite quickly. And I do remember that, you know, when this announcement came out, people, you know, members of the public and lots of astronomers and lots of scientists were very, very excited. But there was also a bit of a backlash in the academic community amongst other astronomers. I don't know if you noticed that. You had some people actually putting out an official kind of statement about how this announcement shouldn't have been handled in this way. And then other astronomers coming in saying, no, 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 that's really unfair.
I was following it a little bit. And in fact, I would say I remember within days of it coming out, there were criticisms. You know, I think this also is worth emphasizing. So science is as close to pure objectivity as human beings can get. I don't want to have this subjectivity-objectivity debate, but it's about as close as you can get to true objectivity. However, it's important to remember that it's a human endeavor. And humans not only make mistakes, but they have motivations. So I could see some people saying, well, you know, they were just going for the big headlines and they wanted the recognition and the glory and all this stuff. And I mean, I'm not sure they were looking for, I don't think they were looking for phosphine. I don't think anybody was necessarily looking for phosphine. They just had this data and they were doing probably Fourier transforms on it. And this signal popped out and they looked it up and said, oh, that's phosphine. You know, imagine you're them and you see this and you're like, whoa, did I just, wow, really? I mean, because you see this thing pop out and you're just like, oh my God, you know. So it makes sense that they would get excited about this, right? You know, what they should have done is they should have, and maybe they did, but what they should have done is they should have gone back and just played around some more. On the other hand, it passed peer review, and it was Nature Astronomy, so it's not like it was some hack journal. The excitement is real. When you make a discovery, you think you made one, and now they say, well, maybe we didn't. You know, and that's science.
And so the last important question on this, if they have downgraded this and they say that the signal is there, but it's 7 times less, does that now definitively rule out the possibility that there are chemists living on Venus?
Oh, well. maybe we'll have to send a probe there to find out.
Right. Okay. Well, that would have been your number one. I thought that was going to be your number one, and then it just sort of fizzled out a little bit. But, you know, and this has now left you in this terrible state where you don't even know at this moment, as we speak, what your number one is going to be. But let's see.
All right. Well, I have one more that didn't make the list.
One more that didn't make your list. Go on then.
I debated about whether this should make the list or not. So we had, of course, we had a special podcast about quantum primacy a little over a year ago, when Google had announced that they had achieved quantum primacy. Again, there was another example of they announced it and then there was some debate about whether it was actually true. There's a group of researchers in China achieved quantum primacy this year with a photonic device. So it's slightly different. Actually, it's very different technology than the Google one. And they were reportedly able to perform 2.6 billion years of computation in 4 minutes. Again, this really only just came out. The main reason I didn't put it on my list is really because we've already talked about quantum primacy. And I believe the Google results. We've already achieved quantum primacy. And I think I don't want to minimize this. This is an amazing project that these folks did. It's a different platform. So it's photonic. The entire underlying technology is different. But the sort of the foundational problem in quantum primacy, we've already talked about and we've already honored. I didn't want to put it in my top five because we kind of already did that.
So go back and listen to our very long, very detailed podcast last year about quantum primacy. And so you can get all the kind of background on the general idea there. Just to say, though, congratulations to the teams involved. Sort of extra special congratulations because we do have a couple of FQXI members involved in this project. Junhui Pan, who led the Chinese team. And I believe they were sort of basing their work on some ideas by Scott Aronson and colleagues, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe that is true, yes.
Well done to our FQXI members there for getting onto the list, getting onto FQXI's end of year list.
Indeed. I believe there will be more FQXI members who make this list.
Oh, and I should also say congratulations to you for coining the term quantum primacy, because I was quite pleased to see that when this came out in the news, you know, you've been pushing for that that term for over a year now, and it has made it into some news sources. So I was quite pleased to see that. So well done to Ian.
Thank you. Let's hope it catches on. I'm not a big fan of the word quantum advantage. It doesn't have the same sense that the original word quantum supremacy does. And I think quantum privacy has that. We'll see where it goes. Hopefully it'll catch on a little bit more.
So yes, the events and accomplishments that almost but didn't quite make Ian's list this year include the rapid development of numerous highly effective COVID vaccines, in particular the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, which are pioneering a new type of mRNA technology, the collapse of the Arecibo telescope, marking the end of an era in astronomy, the groundbreaking discovery that wasn't of possible signs of life on Venus, and another example of quantum primacy, this time in a photonic system. There are more details of each of these on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. Now, those didn't get into Ian's top five. In the next edition of the podcast, we'll find out what did.
So it was a real experiment that tested a very interesting thought experiment that has to do with the very nature of reality and what's better for FQXI than something that's testing the nature of reality.
Thanks again to Ian Durham and to you for listening. As always, you can contact us at podcast@fqxi.org, on Twitter at FQXI, and on Facebook at FQXI Physics. I've been Zia Morali.